Greetings, I am Shusada Kona Kumada. Welcome to Satsang. You are beginningless. You are endless. You are divine.
Good evening, everybody. This is Shusada Kona Kumara. Welcome to Satsang. We are live again with you from Charlotte, North Carolina, and so happy to have you listening tonight. We're going to go ahead and clear the space, so if I can ask you to take a nice deep breath, get yourself centered. Mother, Father, God that I am, through the great central sun hierarchy, through the office of the Christ and the order of Melchizedek, I call upon Archangel Michael to bring the sapphire blue ray. Cut away, cut away, cut away anything in all of our four lower vehicles not emanating directly from our I Am presence. I now call on Archangel Zachiel, keeper of the violet flame. Blaze, blaze, blaze the violet flame through all of our four lower bodies. Transmute, transmute, transmute all the psychic debris Michael has cut free. I now bring forth the invincible ring pass knot and the mirror blue light of invisibility to completely surround each of us. And I call forth a shaft of pure Christ light, one to surround each one of us, and I ask that they be brought to the center of the earth, where I call on Archangel Gabriel to seal them. And I ask that the legions of Michael completely surround each tube of light. And now I ask that our vibrations be raised high above the psychic and astral worlds to the highest realm of illumined truth we each can attain at this time. And now, Mother, Father, God, we place ourselves in service to you and to humanity, and I place myself in service to all of you tonight. We ask that only that which is direct from you be permitted into our perceptions and that all else of the lower mind be kept out. And we ask that only that which is direct from you be permitted through us. And because we have asked this, we consider it so. So be it. Very good. Come on back to me. So, I know exactly what we need to talk about tonight. And yes, I'm just kidding. Because I don't have a clue, as usual. But I had to say that because Megan Davis, our treasurer, was giving me a really hard time about how every time she listens to an archive, I always seem to preface the session by saying, so what are we going to talk about tonight? I have no idea what we're talking about. But you see, this is the way it is. Because in the moment, I don't know what's going to come. And it's not until one of you says something or I'm given something and it just kind of pops in there and I know I need to speak about it. Every now and again, leading up to the show, maybe that morning or in the afternoon, something will come. And I might just see an article or hear a piece of music or something and I'll be just, I'll know, oh, that's what I need to really address tonight. I don't have that tonight, and that's fine. We had a nice session here in Charlotte. I've been on kind of hiatus. If you've been listening and you've been hearing some stuff that you know is older, that's why. I've needed to take some time to finish writing a book, and which is kind of a guidebook for people beginning this work. And I'm really happy to say that the initial writing is done. And hopefully by the end of summer, we can have that in print. So I've been doing that and tying up lots of loose ends so that when I come back, I'll be ready and raring to go. So I'm with you tonight. And then it's probably going to be three more weeks, and then I'll be back with you every Thursday. Don't not listen, please, because we'll play an amazing archive for the next few weeks. And I will say, even when I'm away, I listen to the program myself, and they're impactful for me. You know, that may seem a little weird, but when you recognize that what's coming through during the sessions is just the self, capital S, you know, the self is powerful in any form. So I listen to the self as myself, if that makes any sense. And I really enjoy the programs. I hope you do too. And I also got a comment earlier from PLEN that she listens to the archives at work, and you know, which not everybody can get away with, but she can. And she made the comment that she's always surprised at how much I laugh during the programs. And I hope that you all appreciate that. That's one component of that I think that is a little unique in the way I do my work compared to other quote unquote teachers out there. You know, I'd be more like the laughing Buddha, you know, because so much is funny. And I think we can get so bogged down in the seriousness of spiritual work, and everything is spiritual, and everything that you do in the world where you are consciously striving to move forward is spiritual work. So, you know, I try to not keep it too heavy. The topic matter alone is heavy enough. So I do my best to be relatable and to get in there and make you laugh so that you don't cry instead. Not that tears don't come too, because they do. And I have to say too, it's hard not to laugh when I have to look at PLEN sitting over there with a towel on her head. She looks ridiculous, and I might have to post a picture on Facebook or our BBS page for people to see what I have to put up with over here. It's terrible trying to be serious with her around me sometimes. She's laughing and I'm supposed to be serious, you know. So, okay. So we talked in our prior session. Maybe we should start out where we started there, which was I had a question come forward from Megan Amber. Who was it? Was it Megan? The real, not real?
Oh, no.
It was you? It was both of them. It's a good question. Really hard to answer in a way that the mind will be happy with. The question was, how do you kind of deal with when you hear that this reality, this out-picturing of consciousness that you're seemingly existing in is illusion, that it's not real. But then at the same time, you also hear that it is real, that it's real until it's not. And how do you deal with that? It's a really good question. It is. Maybe I'll answer it better now than I did earlier. I don't know. That, you know, in highest truth, if we want to remember, please, anybody who has experienced, experienced outside of this paradigm is then capable of viewing quote unquote reality from different levels. Yeah. And so the challenge then becomes to bring a level of reality that isn't seemingly real here in here, and to present it in such a way that it opens up the possibility for that to... Gosh, you're killing me. To a consciousness that's enslaved in... can we move her so she's behind me or something? Oh my gosh. Oh, so consciousness being enslaved in polarization. It has to... if consciousness is kind of... Let's say that there's no grace. Let's say that there's no... divine you constantly urging you forward in your evolution back to remembrance. Yeah. Let's say that doesn't exist. It's just the ego, and that's all it is, this lower mind running this program. If you didn't bring higher truths in, there would be no chance, really, outside of grace, which we're pretending doesn't exist, there would be just no chance of ever transcending the life-death cycle. There's just no way it would happen. because the mind is so engaged in not only perpetuating the lie of duality, but working nonstop to continue to prove that that's true, right? And it's so entrenched in doing that, that without grace and without bringing in truths that exist outside of that reality, it just isn't going to get there. You know, even with people who receive higher truths, they still, you know, mostly don't make a whole lot of movement forward in a lifetime. So on one level, you're here until you're not, and it's real until it isn't. And so you are the identified self until it's seen through. Hard to say you are it until you're not, because even the language there messes it up. Because if you really look, this is where I think my training as an English teacher comes in very handy for me. For a while, I was questioning, why on earth did I go through all that? But I understand language in a way that most people don't. And if you say, you know, well, you are it until you're not, then what you're actually saying is that it is true. It's all true. And it isn't. So you are it until it's seen through, you know. And when it's seen through, then what's seen is that you never were. So are you actually ever it? Well, no. Because if it exists, that it can be seen through, and that the experience of it when it's seen through is that you never were, then from that space you never could have been, right? And what you identified with, what you thought yourself to be, could not have been real. You understand? Does that make sense? I'm hoping I am wording that in a way that you can, it's very convoluted, but I'm hoping I can walk you around it so you can see it. That's part of the challenge, you know. And I think that's what differentiates the way I do work from a lot of teachers, is that, or guides, or whatever you want to call everybody. A lot of people who do very deep work, their job is not to get into that lower mind and get it to work with it. Their job is just to bring the truth and have it, you know, have lower mind come up against it and hit that wall where it just stalls out and there's nothing there, you know, and to bring people to that space outside of identification. It's beautiful, really, really beautiful work. The downside to that level of work, in my experience, is that outside of the experience of that, it doesn't leave the individual with the capacity to move into that on their own. Because in one sense, it was facilitated by the energetic that being could bring through, you see. There's a reason that, you know, satsang has been around for thousands of years, because when you bring someone who's outside of that, the energetic comes with them. So just being in the presence of that person shifts your consciousness, you know, it does. And that's why people have all kinds of experiences when they come, and especially if they have an opportunity to sit in long periods with a guide or a guru or whatever you want to term it. And the interesting thing about the work that was given to me and that I walked through on my journey and that I now teach and facilitate is that it actually utilizes that thing that everybody's trying to transcend, you know. You can't, ultimately it is true. You're not going to, the lower mind itself is not going to, quote unquote, achieve liberation. It's impossible, right? It's completely impossible. The program is the program. You will never be enlightened. It's not possible, right? Does that mean that awareness itself and an enlightened state of awareness is not experienced? No, it doesn't mean that. But the you believe yourself to be is not the you that is that, you see. It's outside of reality. And the experience of being in an illumined state, when one has had that through whatever means, you know, it doesn't matter. It's all the same experience. In having that experience, what you recognize after the fact is that within that experience, everything fell away. And mind doesn't quite know what to do with that. But Pielian actually spoke to it nicely earlier in her experience of love, you know, because conceptually we all think we know what love is and how I feel when I'm in love or when I do love. It's very, you know, it's a verb, to love and all these things. But her experience was that when she was love, that there wasn't a doingness to it. It was a beingness. And in that, there really was no her. And that's very accurate. There was no her. There's no other. It just is. It's a state of consciousness, a state of beingness. Yeah. And it isn't until consciousness is re-identified that you actually can look back on it and go, oh, that was that. And of course, now consciousness is going to, because it's identified again, it's going to take a concept and slap that concept on the memory of the experience, you know, and term it something. But in the awareness itself, the beingness itself, none of that exists. It just is, you know, out of space and time, truly out of space and time. It just is. So within the identified you, you know, the you you really believe yourself to be, that I'm a man and I'm 6 foot two and I weigh 240 pounds and I'm 42 years old and I have two children and a wife and a dog named Skippy and a job as an attorney and all of these things, right? And I like Coors Light and Mustang GTs and, you know, Mission Impossible movies, whatever it is. That is truly just a program that was learned, you know, and it molded you into this being that consciousness, which transcends all of it, has identified itself with. It's made itself really small in order to go from being all that is to being a piece of this thing that, you know, you call you. And that's not real. Truly, it isn't. You know, God is all that is, seen, unseen, you know. And you are that. Does it mean that you, as the essence of you, are the totality of God? Not necessarily. But you can't differentiate yourself from all that is. You can't do it. And that's what consciousness is trapped in here, is it has done that. It has said that, but I am this. And it holds God as something outside of itself. Some people, because they've done enough work over lifetimes, come into this lifetime with a different understanding. And I was one of those. Like, I knew I was God. I didn't know what that meant as a kid. You know, when you go to church and they're talking about kind of God out there, it didn't make sense to me because my whole thing, I don't know that I could have intellectually said, I am God when I was real little. I didn't, but I did that pretty quick because I remember saying that when I was like 10. But I knew what I knew from a very young age, from a space of knowing, you know, which I wouldn't have recognized then, was that God was in my heart. Like, I knew that. I knew it, I knew it, I knew it. It wasn't anything I learned. It wasn't anything that was taught in my church. You know, no one said to me, God lives in your heart. I just knew that. And that's why I gave my parents such a hard time about going to church. Why do you need a building? It doesn't make any sense to me. What do you mean God's in a building? How could God be in a building when God's in my heart? God goes with me wherever I go. You know, like, I got that. Well, that's from lifetimes of doing very deep spiritual work. So I carried that. And not to mention outside of it, you know, those of us who have come in service and most likely 99.9% sure that if you're listening to me, you're one of those people. you know, you came here to be in service to help humanity here wake up out of the illusion. So you carry that light within you. You carry that knowing within you, even if you can't put words to it. And even if you don't even recognize it until some point when someone else says it to you and you're like, oh my gosh, on some level, I've always known that. That's so weird that you say that. Like, and I didn't even recognize it until this moment. We all know that. And everybody knows that, you know, it's just for those who have fallen so deeply, it's gotten so covered up. It's just going to take longer for it to get uncovered. That's all. It's not that they don't know it. They've just forgotten. It doesn't change the fact that it is. So from a level of what is truth, you know, polarized consciousness is not real. The all that is can't be broken up into polarized sets of opposites. Because as soon as that's done, you can't be both, can you? You know, how can you be good and bad when one negates the other? How does that work? You see? So the language itself is incredibly limiting. How can you be both when one negates the other? That's why I like the work of Swami Vivekananda. I love his writings. Very Raja Yoga, you know, very mind yoga, which is a good chunk of the kind of work we do. I don't call my work yoga, but of course it is, you know. And Vivekananda would look at consciousness on a sliding scale, which I remember the moment I read that, I was like, oh, that's it. He put, you know, words to something that's it. How can you say one or the other if it exists on a sliding scale with everything in between it being equal, you know? How can it be one or the other when everything in between is equal? It can't, you know? It's just a different amount of each, but it doesn't negate anything. How beautiful, you know? But the mind is not prepared or even capable, really. Well, I say that. Maybe at some point it becomes capable of allowing that to be. The mind wants to say, you know, if it's this, then it's this. It can't be that because it's this. Mind loves black and white thinking. You know, we see that so clearly in the world now. I mean, look at the whole, you know, political mess in the United States. The disaster we call our two-party system. Beautiful. What more representation do you need for duality? Republicans and Democrats. I mean, you couldn't be much more polarized, right? And it used to be that the, at least on the surface, the government functioned by, yes, left and right, but they were mostly centrist people, right? So left-leaning, but more toward the center, right-leaning, more toward the center, so more capable of working with each other and all that stuff. And now what are we sitting with? It's like, whoa, you know? Never the twain shall meet. They're just so far out in both directions. And then there are people just saying, can we please just be reasonable? And you don't know how it's ever going to happen, and everyone's all, you know, flummoxed by the whole thing. But of course, it's happening because it has to, you know. All of that stuff has to come up because people have to start seeing it for what it is. It's not that it wasn't there before. It got covered up better before. Now it's all just hanging out there in the open. Donald Trump is a perfect representative of just, whoa. I mean, it's so extreme. So extreme. And that's a great way to look at the ego itself, you know, the personal self. It's all about me, 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 me. Now on the other side, it's all about me too. Yeah. But that gets covered up with the, we want it to be about you, but because we want it to be about you and it makes us feel good when it's about you, it's really about me. So one's very blatant about the whole self-serving thing, and the other one hides it very well. But don't think it's not going on both sides, because of course it is. Of course it is. And the same could be said of you. You know, where do you sit with that? Are you someone who is, you know, really blatantly selfish and greedy and okay with it? Where people are like, wow, you're so selfish. And you're like, yep, it's all about me. I'm getting mine. Yeah. Because if I don't, someone else will. So, you know, and you're okay with that. All right. And people get very self-righteous and indignant about people like that, right? Oh, he's so selfish. He's so full of himself. And but, you know, it's an interesting thing, hypocrisy, because it's running and you never see it. And the one who would judge that as a negative thing, it's only because it exists within you and you don't want to admit it. So you hide it from yourself. This is the one of the hardest and deepest levels of dissolution work to come to. And it's really not easy, because generally it takes, you know, sometimes literally it takes your guide. Like if you've got a guide in physical form, it takes them to set up a situation that's going to get thrown in your face so blatantly that you have to deal with it. Because the things that you refuse to own as yourself, you will hide from yourself, and you would be amazed at how subtle the mind is and how capable it is of hiding whatever it needs to hide from your conscious awareness. You don't call it the unconscious for nothing. You know, it's true. So when you find yourself really irritated, like really just, oh, I look at Donald Trump and I want to punch him, right? Good. Yeah, good, because you got that too, and you don't want to look at it. So where is it? And that's your job. My job is to find it. And whenever anyone says anything to you that you just get, someone says, man, why are you like that? You always have to be right, don't you? I do not. I don't know what the, you know, as soon as that comes up, that I do not, or you're wrong, you don't know me. Ooh, that's it. You're right there. It's true. And now your job is to go in and see where you are hiding it from yourself, because it is all you. It's all you, right? Remember, one of the things that I've told you, and it's a very powerful teaching, what you can't own is you gets projected into the outside world, all right? The outer world, inner world, same thing. And what happens is, in the inner world, there are things that you're very conscious of, right? In those conscious things, you're capable of kind of looking at and dealing with internally. But all the stuff that you refuse to look at and deal with internally gets pushed. Well, if it's pushed and you're not bringing it to the light, bringing it into a conscious place, it has to present to you, because this is a world of duality. So whatever exists on one side, the opposite side has to be equally present. Equally present. Equally present. It's important. Equal. There is no, you know, the world is 60% good and 40%, but it's equal. I promise you, it's equal. It just hides well. So whatever you're holding, I try so hard, and I always come back to like being kind, because so many people, that's how we're raised. You need to be good. Be a nice person, right? So we all get really programmed to work hard, to be nice, to mind our tempers, to watch our tongues, you know, bite your tongue. It's better not to say anything. You catch more flies with honey, like all of that stuff, yeah? And that's what we're trained to do. So what happens is, when the other side presents, and usually that means we see someone in the world who's not nice, Donald Trump, who could be the kindest man in the world, who knows? But what appears on the outside is he doesn't seem terribly nice. when that's presented to you and you've worked so hard to identify yourself with the opposite of that, right? You're repulsed by what you see. Why? Because you have to believe that the way you hold yourself is the right way. What happens to the ego if it believes the way it holds itself is the wrong way? Implosion. Right? Whatever it looks like, everyone walking the planet is actually believing that they're doing the right thing. As twisted as that may seem from your vantage point, that's what everyone's sitting in. Whatever choices are being made, which of course are coming directly out of the patterning, those choices are being made because they truly believe that that's the right thing to do, given their lens, right? Given their lens, which is not going to necessarily be your lens. But you do the same thing. So the choices that are being made are coming directly out of the patterning, because the patterning dictates the choices. And it does it because it thinks it's the right thing to do. Now, how can that be real? You know, I mean, like, sit with that for a second. That's a really lofty thing to put out there and hard to get around. So let's look at a real life example. Yeah. Someone who yells at his kid. Like, yells at his kid. Not like you kind of raise your voice to get their attention, or someone who yells at his kid. And the world looks, let's say he does it in a grocery store, right? You can all relate to this. Everyone seems to have been someplace before where you hear a mother or father like scream at their kid, yeah, or smack their kid. And some people are like, that kid probably had it coming. Other people are recoiling in horror. Oh my God. You son of a bitch, right? Yeah. But if you were capable of getting into the space of the parent who just did that, yeah, what you would recognize is they have a belief that they did it because it was the appropriate thing to do in the moment. And they would use something as like, you know, it's the only thing that makes an impact with him. He doesn't listen if I try to talk to him. He doesn't listen if I take things away. He doesn't listen. But if I smack him, he listens. If I smack him, I get the outcome that I'm needing or wanting, right? So you see, in that space, of course, it's all ego-driven, of course, because if he was sitting in the space of the heart, then remorse would come on the backside of it very quickly, you know, of recognizing that he just inflicted pain, and the heart doesn't feel good about that kind of thing and would need to make it right. But from the space of the ego, you have to recognize in the moment when that child is doing whatever the child's doing, you know, grabbing stuff off the shelves, or maybe he knocked a bottle of wine over in the grocery store and it broke, you know, in that moment, dad, in this case, we'll say dad feels victimized, powerless, has no control over what just happened. He's embarrassed. Yeah. He feels humiliated. Total victimization. And who was the perpetrator? His kid. So completely loses sight of the love he carries from his heart for his child. And in the moment reacts from the space that was programmed and imprinted on him. Most likely he was struck as a child, right? So he could have grown up hating that, hating the pain that it brought him, hating all of it. But in the moment where it's triggered, you know, it's going to be the most natural thing for him to do. And because it's the natural thing for him to do, instead of, and maybe in the beginning, the first time or two he hit his child, he felt remorse and felt terrible about it because it did bring up for him the pain he felt as a child when he was hit. What the mind's going to do is it automatically moves to find justification for it. If he stays in the space of remorse, he's got to work through that, doesn't he? Right? Because now in that, you know, he is his own perpetrator. And he's playing perpetrator and victim in the same space, you know.
And that is a very hard space to sit in. It takes a lot of courage to walk through that. And that's what people who do this work are doing all the time. You're walking through that level where you can see you are your own perpetrator, you know, and you have to deal with that. Well, people can't do that. So the mind is going to automatically look for a way to justify the behavior. So it makes it palatable. And that's what that whole thing is, you know. You shouldn't have pushed me. Justification. You had it coming. Justification. I told you not to do that. You didn't listen. Justification. You see, that's what all that is. And the whole point of all of it is I'm saying it because in my saying it and me pushing that belief system on you and making you have to accept it, then I can live with myself for the fact that I just did what I just did. Right. And I can stay in that level of denial that I'm carrying that what I did wasn't okay. And that's exactly what happens. And the child gets imprinted with it. So you have the child who ends up carrying the guilt that was imposed by the parent. The child who thinks they were wrong, you know. They were wrong. It was my fault. He told me it was my fault. And for the child who looks to a parent as the seeker looks to God, not any different, that's what they come away with. And they feel very conflicted because, you know, the child won't understand. They just innocently enough reached for a brightly colored cereal box, let's say, you know. And dad comes up right behind him and smacks him on the hand. Put that down. The child has no idea what he did wrong. I mean, you know, just wanted to pick it up. It was all innocent enough, right? But it gets shown to him and demonstrated to him very swiftly that what you just did was bad. I mean, most parents would say it. Don't be a bad boy. And now what did you just teach the child? That the very innocent exploration of the world is not okay, you know. We wonder why so many kids get so withdrawn into themselves and they're afraid of expression and, you know, voicing their fears or hopes or concerns or any of it because they can't. But what I want you to see is the innocence behind all of it, you know. Dad didn't do it because he doesn't love his son. In some contorted way, Dad did it because he does love his son. Does that make sense? He wants his son to do what's right. Well, okay. That's an honorable enough thing. Now, Dad's view of what's right may be what's wrong. But is Dad going to see that? No. Why would he? Why would he walk through life saying to himself, you know, everything I think is right is wrong. I'm an idiot. I mean, how many people are going to do that? You have to understand, it takes a very good amount of self-esteem for a person to get to the place where they can admit that, where they can actually say, wow, all those things that I held as right really weren't. You know, for most people, their self-esteem just isn't enough that they can handle acknowledging I was wrong. I mean, God, we see that every day. How hard is it to get an honest, sincere, simple apology out of a person? How many people, when they do something that they then go back to apologize for, don't follow the apology with a but or an or? I'm sorry I hit you when I came through, but you were in the way. Oh, so it's still my fault. Great. I'm sorry I yelled at you, but you shouldn't have been doing what you were doing. I'm sorry I stole your wallet, but you shouldn't have left it sitting out. Or whatever it is, right? More justifiers. Why can't people just say, I'm sorry? I'm sorry I hurt you. And have that be it? Because they're not strong enough to say, I'm sorry I hurt you. The self-esteem is so low that they have to cover it up and still make you wrong. And then somehow convince themselves that they've apologized, you know. The ego has no self-esteem. You understand? It really doesn't. If you take it back to that moment of what it perceived as its separation, you know, it doesn't know what it did wrong. It is that child that just got smacked down the hand in the grocery aisle. It doesn't understand. What did I do? Why are you hurting me? I'm sorry. You know, how do I make it better? And the child would be, you know, just like a puppy. You kick a puppy and it runs right back to you. I'm so, well, you know, it just wants love. And a child would do the same thing. It doesn't understand why it just got hit or yelled at. And it automatically goes right back to you to show its love for you, right? And what is it met with? More yelling or consternation, or you shut them down altogether and refuse to talk to them or send them away. You know, that's what they get back. So what does that do to the psyche? You know, when you've had that done to you as a child, and all children, I mean, just about all children on the planet have gone through that. Why? Because they're a product of their patterning, and their parents were a product of their patterning, and on and on and on, you know. And even for those parents who have consciously done the opposite, Linda, I'm going to look at you here, right? You grow up in really horrendous circumstances and you consciously do the opposite. I will not be that, right? And you work overtime to not be that. It's still going to show up someplace and it's hidden from you. So there are places where that cruel parent comes out, but you can't see it. You just literally can't see it. And if for some reason someone brings it to your attention, you still won't see it. You'll justify your way out of it. Oh, I wasn't doing that. That was, oh, you misunderstood what I was saying, or you didn't see that right, you know, because they literally can't see it. You've got to have a serious willingness to uncover all of it to get in there and recognize those things in yourself. You know, especially when it's something you hold so hard because it negatively impacted you before. So you've consciously taken on the other side and you are really working to hold that. That's your reality, you know. Are you wrong for holding that? No, you're not wrong for holding that. It was taught to you. It was taken on. Yeah. Where you become wrong for holding it is when you become conscious of it and continue to do it anyway. Yeah. Now we're in a different arena altogether. But it's innocent enough when it's playing and when you don't know any better. You know, they say ignorance is bliss. I mean, there's truth to that. You don't know any better and you just are what you are and there it is. But when you decide it's time to unearth it and to get in there and dig it all up, now, guess what? Now you're responsible for what you've seen. And now it's time to function from a different place. Now, that's not to say outside of the identification that some of that wouldn't run, because it could, you know. The self moves through all things and it moves through things in ways that you never know how it's going to appear. And sometimes it can appear as a dad smacking his son, believe it or not. And every time, regardless of how it appears, it's there it's there as a as the gift, you know, to show something, to show a component where we're holding it too tightly, where we're attached, and where we refuse to look beyond it or refuse to look deeper into it. You know, that's why it's always coming. Give you another opportunity to look and another opportunity to look. And when the seeing is completed and the story itself dissolves away, it doesn't need to appear anymore, you know, and it just kind of stops appearing. It may appear once in a while, but at that point, it doesn't matter because there's nothing attached to the appearance of it or not. Yeah. You understand, that's the, I know a lot of the things that I say, like, there's a part of you that can kind of catch it, you know, but you can't hold it. And I totally get that. You know, you don't hold it until you've owned it, until it's been experiential for you. And that's what allows you to hold it and to hear it from a different level, you know. And for most people, when you hear me speak, you know, if it doesn't completely boggle the brain, you will have those moments where, oh, like you see it, but you, and then you're trying to grab it because it's so fleeting, you know, it was there and now it's flying away again. Come back, come back. And that has to happen over and over and over. And that's why I talk the way I talk, bringing you the multiple levels, all the paradoxes and all of it, because it has to be presented. We're going right back to where we started. It has to be presented. If it wasn't, you'd never move anywhere. So I've got to bring you things that make you go, what? Or bring you things that make you angry. You know, oh my God, she was talking about Donald Trump. I don't think I like her anymore. That no good for nothing racist, blah, blah, you know, whatever it is. And if you're going to call him a racist with hate in your heart, how are you any better? I'm sorry. How are you any better? You know? And this is something that I said to someone recently. I don't remember who it was. But I was saying that, you know, judging doesn't disappear. You can still judge things, right? But what disappears in dissolution work is the withholding of love that comes with judgment from the level of the ego. So in judging Donald Trump for the ego, it judges him and it uses its judgment as the thing to allow it to feel better about itself, to allow its self-righteousness to be propped up and stroked, you know, to show how wrong he is, because that shows how right I am, to align myself with those others who think the way I think and are like-minded. Love that term, like-minded. As if, you know, we all have to band together. All of those who think the way we think, we're special, you know. Outside of the ego, could I judge Donald Trump and say Donald Trump is racist? Yes. Because look at the words, yeah? Look at the actions. It's right there. But the difference is that it doesn't make me dislike him. It doesn't make me think anything less than concerning him. He's just as equal a piece of divinity as the Dalai Lama or Pope Francis. No, yes. You see, I can love him and know that what the ego expressing is Donald Trump. I can see what it's caught up in, and I see the innocence in it. I see why it's perpetuated. I see all of it. Yeah. But I don't judge him as the essence of him based on something that he can't help. You understand? He can't help it. He's got no other recourse. It's the program is off and running and there's no one in the building. You see? The lower mind isn't conscious. He hasn't woken up to that level of consciousness yet where he can, where conscious awareness can actually start coming forward, right? That's what deep seekers move into. You actually can become conscious in your own life. And I know that's a very hard thing to wrap yourself around, because if you tell me I'm unconscious, I don't think I'm ready for that. But that is what I'm telling you. The ego isn't conscious. It is a program, and it's running the way it's been patterned to run, you know. How do you blame someone for that? That's where I sit with it. And it all comes down to starting to tune into that space of the heart, you know, where, and not heart the way the mind wants to think of it, but just tuning into the place of compassion that can recognize, of course you see the world the way you see the world. If I were raised the way you were raised and taught what you were taught, I'd view the world the same way. I can't hold myself as outside of that. I can't say I wouldn't be Donald Trump if I was raised in the same exact conditions, right? And the heart has compassion from that space, from the space of innocence. And that is such a big component. If you do nothing else, just start working on compassion. You know, it's so beautiful. So in wrapping up tonight, we're going to do our meditation like we normally do. And this is particularly apropos tonight because the name of the song is Listen With Your Heart. Yeah. So until next week, and until I'm back with you live, please listen to the archives. But until next week, we love you so very much, and thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.
You are beginningless. You are divine. You are divine.